Stories That Matter, Hawkwood's podcast series which invites changemakers, thinkers, artists and innovators to discuss the stories that have influenced them, their visions for the future and the actions that they are taking to change the world. Today we are talking to Sarah Cablatin from the Philippines. Sarah is a regenerative design and development specialist and has been weaving experiences in the fields of peace building, biocultural heritage, environmental education, mental health, and humanitarian innovation for around 20 years. Her lifelong practice is in restoring and restorying narratives of place and belonging with a trauma-informed approach to ecosystem regeneration and leadership. She is currently a freelance consultant on regenerative strategy, facilitation, and learning. One of her current projects is leading the development and delivery of a bioregional governance training for the Asia-Pacific region. So, Sarah, welcome to Hawkwood's podcast and welcome back to Hawkwood. So, Sarah, you first came to Hawkwood. We were working out it was in 2022 and it was a joint collaborative project supported by the British Council with One Resilient Earth in Germany. And it was such a joyful moment, and I learned so much through the project. And I just wondered if you could share a little bit about it here today and how that's influenced your work.
Thank you so much, Alicia, for having me. I feel so grateful to be here. I feel like a lot of memories flood back. I remember I was here earlier before the residency that we did come, and it was really a special time because you had this sudden snow that was not in schedule. So Hawkwood was blanketed in this snow and such a, I don't know how the feeling is, but it reminds me of this silence that when you walk in the snow, there's this very peaceful, I cannot describe the silence, but it is a very peaceful silence. But anyway, when I think about that, I'm transported to that time. And being with the people that we work with, Laureline and the artists from the UK and artists from the Philippines, when we did an exchange online and in person here, first of all, it was not just profound for like the collective of my people coming from a climate vulnerable country. It was also very profound for me because I have put my path on working with the arts and culture on hold for many years because I was working with permaculture in disasters and displacement. So that project actually was very healing for me in many levels.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, because I've always wanted to work for climate change, but I've always wanted to be an artist, and in my world, it was not possible to do both because often funding was mainly for, you know, food security or restoring landscapes, or either funding was, in my country, it's limited compared to your country to do the arts and culture. So it was like either or. But finally, when we put it together, it was like, wow, I didn't realize how it healed the many parts that I wanted to hold together for so long. So thank you for that opportunity.
Fantastic. And the project was about restoring your narratives.
Yeah.
Maybe tell us a little bit about how that worked.
So we had the title of the project was called Restoring Landscapes in a Changing Climate. And so we work with not just the artists, but also we had a climate scientist. We had a therapist who worked in the front lines. We also engaged people who work with the lands, because this wasn't just about the arts. We wanted to find the meaning of working with the land as an entry point to understand our climate challenges and the solutions that, you know, that could come from that. And the exchange we did online, we had an online journey for several months, and we really explored the challenges, the issues people face on climate, the climate crisis. And then we exchange on creative lenses and tools so that we can change the narrative. So the arts became like a tool to... So think about climate science has a lot of language. It's already a set system of defining, right? A procedure of measuring carbon or measuring the heat or the risk index. Those are very scientific climate language. But there's limited language on, you know, expressing the soul or expressing the meaning of the climate reality. And that meaning is lost if we don't have the narratives, the stories that make data valuable.
Yes.
You have all the numbers, but, you know, but who are these people? Or who are these species? You know, what's their story? And what's why are they important? That's the most important thing.
Yes.
And what is the meaning behind all this? What is it informing us in this time when you are in a chaos? It's very hard to navigate, right? Because you have to reorient yourself. Like, I think about right now when we're recording this, the LA fires was just happening,
right? Yeah.
And I think it's still ongoing. And it's very devastating. And if you think of just 2024 being the hottest year on record to date, because some people will listen to this the year after, and maybe that year is actually much higher than this year. But and we have crossed the 1.5 degrees threshold. And for many years, that 1.5 degrees has been like a maximum.
Yes.
Like that we should never go beyond 1.5. All the climate talks, the plans should be within that. That's the threshold.
Yes.
But because we are, a lot of the devastation and the policies are driven by data, maybe there was missing information on missing ways of landing the urgency and importance. And so when the chaos happens with these fires and in our country a lot of floods, we tend to get lost about how to deal with the crisis.
Yes.
And the arts and culture are important pathways to help us create meaning, help us make sense, and help us give value and importance and bring the message across to land from the level of empathy, the level of, if not empathy, understanding.
Yes. Right?
Because if policymakers don't really understand if that heat is extreme, you know, why would they make policies that would prevent further increase of these greenhouse gases? So we
it's found a way of connecting, really,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes. So, sorry,
it's just really important for people to have an access in understanding the data.
Yes.
And I know that some of the artworks that were produced through that project have had a really big impact. In fact, on me personally, I particularly remember the film that was made.
Yeah.
Share a little bit about that film.
Yeah.
That was beautiful.
Yeah. The artist, his name is Hans Laurentino. He's someone who has worked in the media industry. He's a filmmaker. And I remember when he was still like in his early 20s, I think, and he's still defining what he wanted to do, but he really felt called to use film to tell the story of change. And his background, really, he was doing all these, he was helping direct the film for ecotourism in the Philippines. But this experience gave a little bit of the creative part as a filmmaker, like kind of an experience for him to explore more creative way of communicating. And so there was the short film, the clip that he did was especially from the super typhoon Rai, which happened in 2021 in our city where he lives and I live. And he was there, you know, in the aftermath. It is a category one storm that became category 5 overnight. So it's not something like you just, oh, that's a storm. This was cataclysmic. And
absolutely. Yeah.
And so what he did was, his clip was the same roadside for a few minutes, but he interspersed it with clips of the aftermaths of the same sides that he was passing through that street. And so you have one, it's like your eyes were blinking.
Yes.
So you close your eyes, you open, right? So when your eyes is open, you're seeing what it is now, but then you close it, you're seeing what it was during the typhoon aftermath, and then open, close.
So it was like, deeply powerful.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, very beautiful work. Yeah. And I really celebrate that project. So thank you for your enormous contribution to making it happen with Laureline from One Resilient Earth as well.
Yeah, so powerful.
So powerful, yeah. So, Sarah, in your wider work, you are often on the international stage and as a convener and as a speaker. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered what you've been working on recently internationally or are going on to do.
Yeah, good question. Because I think because I've been working more local for the last 7 years with my nonprofit Green Relief, and now that I've closed that, I'm starting to go back to the wider regional and global space. Recently, I've been more active with the Conscious Food Systems Alliance. This is convened by UNDP. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting alliance because, for one, you have consciousness in the word, in the
title.
And then you have UN, which is a very rare combination of words. And I'm part of the Inner Council. And we have been helping bring in a more awareness-based approach to food systems leadership. Because, yes, so many policies are there, so many solutions are there, but how can people lead and respond to the food crisis? And food systems actually are, like, if I'm not mistaken, it's like a major contributor to the climate emissions. It's probably even 3/4, 75%. Because you have the sourcing, you have the things that emit from the production. And then from the distribution, you have to have a lot of logistics and shipment. I'm just here. The other day, I was looking for something, and I went through one of your supermarkets, M&S or Salisbury.
Sainsbury's, like,
yeah. All these food, lots of food prepared, and all the ingredients of that, not all of this come from the UK, right?
No, that's right.
Yeah, and so you think about all the logistics of production and then disposal so it's a major thing. So I'm helping bring in more on the inclusion of indigenous wisdom and traditional knowledge, but also regenerative food systems. So that's one. Second is currently I'm also one of the innovators for Unorthodox, which is like a think tank working on regenerative futures. So it used to be the Luck Hoffman Institute, founded by one of the founders of WWF is Luck Hoffman. Yeah.
And so where is that based?
It's
Swiss. Okay.
Yeah. So recently we had a retreat where they brought in a lot of the Global South innovators working for regeneration. Of course, it was a good mix, but often we don't really hear much of the Global South innovators on regeneration. So they're trying to bring in, weave the experience and recommendations. How does a regenerative future look like from? And I'm one of the innovators they invited to. And it helps me with, thanks to our work together.
Oh,
because
good.
that work really reignited my arts and culture, and it made me feel I need to step into this because I'm lost with my soil work. I need to restore my soul work, and with that, I'm also strengthening the legacy project from our work called Restore Restory, which is helping document and regenerate climate loss and damage, especially the biocultural heritage, which is a non-economic loss and damage in the climate change.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about that.
Yes,
specifically. Yeah. How are you working with that?
Yeah, so I used to work for a museum before I embarked on the Rainbow Warrior of Greenpeace, where I was converted into the climate movement years ago. So my first job was really, I really want to work with the arts.
Yes.
And then I was like, well, the planet really is, wow, this is crazy. What's going to happen in the next 10, 15 years coming from a country that's climate vulnerable? So I've always wanted the idea of museums to be living museums, not the colonial history of museums.
Absolutely,
but
yes.
Museums are community spaces that are holding the stories of the land and the wisdom of the land. And since we've been developing permacultural learning sites in indigenous communities with farmers and indigenous peoples, where we weave their traditional ecological knowledge, we develop a learning site for enhancing their food production after climate disasters. We also share seed saving. We also help them propagate trees, native trees, to restore the landscape and protect from future disasters. So if we were doing that, why don't we also not just save seeds, but tell the story of these seeds and the folklores and the myths and the rituals held in the land, because they hold a lot of meaning to the people.
Absolutely, yes.
Because if we lose the meaning and value of our land, the rituals make it more meaningful for us to have a relationship with our ancestors or the spirits of the land or the creator. And if we lose that relationship, it's easier for us to chop down a tree, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or it's easier for us to sell our land and give that up. But because but that's also the risk a lot of indigenous communities face because of climate change and other inequitable economic systems. They're forced to whether sell their land or deforest their land for GMOs, which is also a story of the communities we work with. So, but if we were saving the seeds and hold the stories of the seeds in their library, or if their garden, the food forests were growing with them, tells a story of their medicinal plants or the sacred teachings of their ancestors, if this is expressed through the arts and culture, then we offer that meaning. Plus, if these are already at climate risk from loss and damage, which is loss and damage for people to be familiar, because in the climate change world, for many years, the solutions were always just focusing on climate mitigation,
yes,
prevent more carbon emissions, not just carbon, sorry, greenhouse gas emissions. So you try to have renewable energy or you keep carbon in the ground. But climate adaptation is also where you make solutions because the climate disasters and impacts are already there. So you either strengthen your river banks with more trees that would hold the soil or you create systems for people to prepare early warning in disasters so they can just adapt that it's there, but they have less loss and impact.
Yes.
But recently, the last few years, was the growing awareness that there are countries who will have limited or already have limited capacity to either mitigate, adapt to the climate impacts because they're already experiencing severe loss and damage. Mm-hmm. These are loss of life, a big thing, loss of livelihoods, loss of other things that are tangible, but what we're working on is primarily the intangible, the non-economic loss and damage. So these are the biocultural heritage, indigenous wisdom, the identity and sense of belonging of the people and the place, because you cannot quantify that. But because that is so important in ensuring that the people protect their landscape, they have a sense of agency and value to keep protecting their landscapes and ecosystems. And
by sharing those stories and protecting that heritage, it also really strengthens the community together because there is a shared understanding or respect that is built through sharing these stories and also sense of pride. It's so important.
Yes.
Wonderful. So you have been actually restoring land back home, haven't you?
Yeah.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, and it's very much connected also with the Living Museum places. So the Living Museum places really focus more on the indigenous territories. But this is partly personal and partly collective, a contribution to the city, the island of Cebu, where I'm from, where I was born. Because last year I found out, so we brought Indigenous Wisdom Keepers to my city.
Yes.
As a part of a remembering of ancestral farming wisdom, because my island, Cebu City is part of Cebu, the island, is the first Spanish settlement, first Spanish government was set up there as well. And because of that, a lot of our ancestral knowing was wiped out. Right. So we brought in with the wisdom keepers from, like Mamerto was here also, and a woman from the other island doing Babaylan work, and then an indigenous chieftain who I've worked with the peace process. They came, but when they came, they actually said, let's go to your land and study what's the history of your land. And we found out that my ancestors have actually been supporting rituals to, you know, to honor the nature spirits and the creator and the ancestors of the land.
How affirming for you.
Yeah,
wanting
because
to do this work.
It was right under my nose.
It was there.
Yeah, right. And just think, I've been working with these wisdom keepers for years.
Yes.
Because, you know, I understand, like, we don't have it at home. You know, it's because that's the longing, no? And it's just right under my nose. So part of the intention is to offer part of the land as an arboretum and a sacred grove for remembering the ancestral farming practices of that land, more also to honor the Babaylans, which are the pre-colonial shamans of the Philippines, because they were wiped out during the Spanish colonization because of Christianity, you know, saying that they're superior to the belief system. And they have been, like the witches, I don't know if it's appropriate to say witches, but women who have been accused of witchcraft and killed all over here in your land. So the same story happened, and they carry so much of the wisdom and relationship to nature that their persecution also kind of led to us being disconnected to our land. But we're not doing this to say we say no to Christianity. We're actually involving some priests working with Laudato Si, which is, you know, the Pope's guidance on caring for the earth, because maybe the goal is to create a restorative relationship with the land, without saying that the teachings of Jesus Christ is, you know, not included here. Actually, in fact, the true teachings is about the deeper relationship to the sacred and the creator, and involves being in relationship with nature. So that is kind of what's happening in this moment.
It was really interesting also speaking to Mamerto, who has been here with us this week, about embracing the new, embracing the current, and possibly future developments into this ancient way of being. So it's not saying there's only one way, as you're so beautifully describing now. This is that it is complex, and we need to navigate these things collaboratively and together. Interesting.
Wow. I'm still wrapping my head around it, to be honest.
So this is a bit of a personal question for you. Is there anyone you think has been a major influence or inspiration in your life, or even a specific experience or philosophy that has shaped your thinking and approach to what you do?
Yeah, good question. That's very hard.
I shouldn't have sprung that one on
I know,
you,
no,
should
no.
I?
It's very hard because there's so many people.
So many, yeah.
And so many, you know, wisdom traditions and keepers. I don't know why. What comes to my mind is dream guidance, maybe.
Ah,
yeah, I communicate with my guides, I guess. I have this powerful dream from 2013.
Yes.
Was it 2012 or 2013? And I had this dream of a wise woman, an old woman, and she was showing me these two hoops. And the other hoop is a hoop with cowhide, like the Native American, I think that's what it was. The other hoop was a rainbow thread. And she was showing me that there is a difference between being a leader and a shaman. And I think that's what's showing up to me in my life. That's what I've been listening to now. Like, I mean, but also that they can be together. And this sacred work and work with, you know, the I'm not saying it's not sacred, but, you know, the working with the spirit and working with the physical, I guess, is the leadership and the shamanic work together. It's, I feel like, for me, that's guidance, that's inspiration. Like, I cannot also just purely work with the wisdom keepers, but I'm also working with governments and business leaders and and civil society innovators. And how can we bring the sacred in our remembering in how we lead? Because I think that's what's missing now. And I don't know why that comes into mind, because that's that's something
powerful.
It's showing up to me just recently. Like, remember you had the dream. But I guess one thing that's related to that, though, a woman who's really inspiring to me, actually, because when after that dream, it's related to a message I got from Dr. Elizabeth Lindsay, who's a National Geographic explorer. And she's Polynesian, Hawaiian. And I remember... she had this pioneers and TED talk, you know, she was mapping the human story as an explorer of the National Geographic. And she was really, very dedicated to documenting and helping keep the wisdom of the ancestral knowing. And she, one of the words she said, like, if the elders, I cannot quote the exact thing, but she said that when elders die, a whole library is burned. So when these stories are lost, you know, and I was so struck by that. And I remember the dreaming is connected to that. And I felt like deeply connected to that call. And that also, I think the power of working with the arts and culture is we're not just working with memory, cultural memory or climate memory, but also invites us to imagination. So, and I'm also drawn to, like, how can we also imagine the future that's not yet there, and bring us to the remember our creative power, because we are co-creators, right? We can birth children, we can create civilizations, and but we can also be causing downfall of civilization and cause harm. And so if we're capable of that, we can create a future that we want. So, and that's, of course, a deep requires a lot of remembering of our capacity to create, rather than consume and destroy. So I guess that those themes of dream guidance, the work of Dr. Elizabeth Lindsay, the work of wisdom keepers, the work also of futurists, maybe the people who are helping pave something that has not yet been there, you know, and that's not the grammar that is not yet there. I can't really name people, but I believe in the innovators that I've worked with, and the people that I work with, people like you, who are creating these spaces where people can rest and reflect and imagine the future. That is so important.
It's really, well, you know, Hawkwood, we've actually called ourselves a Center for Future Thinking, because we want to create a place for imagining.
That's true, I forgot about that.
Imagining the future. And, you know, we've worked with some wonderful futurists and people coming here to guide people to open up that creative space. So, in fact, we included futures literacy in the Creative Week we started with, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
When that process of...
Yeah, Laureline hosted that.
Laureline hosted that, that's right.
Yeah, because it's necessary. We're not just talking about the past, but how can the learning from the past...
inform our future.
From the present, you know, where we are now.
Wonderful. Good. And so probably going to draw us to a close in the moment, because your Hawkwood lunch is waiting on the table, and I don't want you to miss out.
I love the memory. We should include the Hawkwood lunch in this podcast, because that is one of the memorable things of being in Hawkwood, all the good food.
Good food. It's very important to us here. But I was just wondering if there was anything else before we closed you would like to share with us at all, or maybe even what are you looking forward to, or what are you going on to next? Oh my goodness, there's four questions there.
So it's very interesting to have like a timestamp of when this was recorded, and it helps me kind of look back probably in the future. But I'm heading to Davos next week to the World Economic Forum, a place that I'm completely unfamiliar with. It is not my world. But I feel like lately a lot of this weaving of different sectors and different spaces to address the climate crisis and the systemic crisis from a systemic understanding has brought me to understand the different positionings of the crisis. So I'm also curious where am I being led, but I bring with me our experience with working with non-economic loss and damage, because if in a World Economic Forum you talk about economics, then you bring in what is non-economic. You cannot measure that. You cannot even, if you pay loss and damage funds or carbon credits, these are not, it's not the same amount. If you lose your children, if you lose your home, it's not the same. But how do we create a deeper understanding and meaning around that? Another is to the deeper dialogues with the business sector, because most of the time we've been working with the civil society and the government, but actually the business sector plays an important big role in the climate crisis, but we've never really reached out, and we have been in this cycle of victim, oppressor, hero. I'm the hero, I'm the victim, but they are the oppressor, and we keep repeating that dance while we need to be trauma-informed about it, acknowledging that it is important to call them out. But it's also like maybe there are spaces we've never really truly heard each other, and maybe the spaces of deeper listening and deeper witnessing is possible. So that's also where I'm exploring at the moment.
Well, Sarah, there is so much richness always in your thoughts and your contributions. So thank you for all you do out in the world.
Thank you for helping me imagine. When I'm always here, I'm like going to the past when I was imagining the future possibilities.
Yes. So thank you for this. It's an honor to host you here this week.
You.
So I look forward to welcoming you back very soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.